For bibliophiles who like the feel of books and the look of the printed word on the page, the advent of the electronic book has been greeted with a fair amount of skepticism. So far, no electronic reader has overtaken the book, but Amazon's Kindle has been causing a stir. It was released last fall and may now be facing its ultimate test, summertime, and the ravages of sun, sand, and water. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
At Book Expo, the book industry's annual convention held this year in L.A., there was a palpable buzz of curiosity about the Kindle. Not only did Amazon founder Jeff Bezos fill a ballroom for a presentation extolling the virtues of the reading device, but on the convention floor, people who had never seen a Kindle were eager to get a look at it, or in my case, to get my hands on it.
Can I feel it? Yeah. Can I see what
you can,
it feels like?
You can put your hands all over
okay.
my lovely Kindle.
It's very light, isn't it?
Ooh, yes.
I just did something.
Yep.
What I did was inadvertently touch the button that takes you to the next page. It's easy to do because the button is big. It runs along the side of the screen and is almost as long as the Kindle itself. According to Jay Marine, that was a deliberate design choice. Marine is director of product management for the Kindle.
We have very prominent page-turning buttons because when you're reading a book and you're sitting down, you don't want to be thinking about where the page-turn button is. You want to get lost in the story, which was the total goal of our design. And so by making that seamless where you can put your hands anywhere, when you're reading a book, you really come to appreciate that.
But is it really possible to lose yourself when reading a book on an electronic device? Sure, the Kindle is light, about the weight of a paperback, and slim. It would fit into most bags easily. But under the screen are a bunch of buttons, similar to the keys on a computer. And I can't help thinking, wouldn't all those buttons get in the way of a good read? And what if you get sand or water on them? Not a problem, according to Marine.
We like to say it's sort of like treat it like your BlackBerry or other device. I would definitely take it to the beach, but I wouldn't bury it.
Marine says they're pretty sure a little sand won't hurt the Kindle because they've done a lot of testing on it.
We knew people were going to throw it in their bag, they're going to drop it, they're going to take it to the beach. Like, it has to work where you want to read. You know, we haven't solved the problem of being underwater and reading with it, but we're going to work on that one.
Okay, that sounded like a challenge. So I took the Kindle to the neighborhood pool on a hot summer day. I was joined by Rob Pegoraro, who writes about technology and reviewed the Kindle for the Washington Post. His Kindle was snuggled between the covers of a brown leather-like case.
So that makes it feel a little bit more like a book, huh?
It probably counts as pleather, actually. I don't think it's actual leather.
Pegoraro says the Kindle, like the Sony Reader, its main competitor, is actually quite easy to read outdoors because it's not backlit and uses a kind of technology that makes the screen readable in direct sunlight. But the Kindle's big advantage over other electronic readers is that it's the only one with wireless capability. That allows readers to download books, newspapers, and magazines from Amazon pretty much anywhere at any time. Amazon currently has 125,000 titles available for downloading onto the Kindle and will convert others for a fee. Rob Pegoraro scrolls through a couple of the titles on his.
See, we've got a copy of The Great Gatsby. And a copy of Michael Lewis's Moneyball, the book about baseball and statistics.
Let's go to The Great Gatsby.
Yeah.
Pegoraro read The Great Gatsby on his front porch, and while he did manage to forget he was reading it on an electronic device, he also encountered a few problems. Hitting those page-turning buttons by accident was one of them. And when he wanted to go back and reread something, it wasn't easy.
If you can see, the screen is a little bit slow. Pressing the previous page button, and it flashes, and then I'm back. That's fine for going one page at a time as you're reading, but if you want to go back two chapters to see, okay, you know, what did Daisy first say when they met, you're sort of waiting. You can also do a search, which can be a little easier. Let's see, where is the search function on here?
Well, while Pegoraro was tracking down his search function, I decided to go for a swim.
Okay.
A few minutes later, back on the side of the pool, I was ready to explore the Kindle on my own.
All right, so I'm still dripping.
Here you are.
I'm still dripping, but I just pushed that turning page button by mistake, and I'm dripping on it. Is that a problem? Look.
Pegoraro assured me a few drops won't hurt the device, but looking around the poolside, he assessed the threats to the electronic reader, and a lot of water is one of them.
This is not water resistant so far as I know. I haven't put it to that test yet. There's concrete underneath this, so that Inside this case, it's probably all right if I dropped it just a few inches, but I wouldn't play catch with it.
Is it sturdier or more durable than other kinds of technology that somebody might bring to a pool, like a cell phone, for instance, let's say?
I think it's probably about the same level of durability. In some ways, it has more moving parts. The screen is certainly, this is an unusual kind of electronic paper screen. I don't want to know what it costs to fix.
Pegoraro's leather case provides some protection, and one young woman I talked to said she puts her Kindle in a Ziploc bag to protect it from water, dirt, and especially suntan lotion. Damaging a Kindle would be costly. The device sells for $360. That price tag was one of the things that put off Beau Marshall. He was sitting nearby reading a book, so we asked him to take a look at the Kindle. Marshall was impressed by the device, but said he probably wouldn't buy one.
The electronics is great if it were virtually free, you know. And if you're raised with them, I understand the kids and the younger generations would probably prefer that. But being rather retro, to put it charitably, I would probably prefer, all things being equal, the printed page.
The Kindle, says Pegoraro, may be beating the competition at the moment, but it still has a way to go before it changes the way most of us read.
They've still got some learning to do with designing gadget interfaces. It's not quite the iPod of e-book readers.
But if the Kindle isn't the future, you can see it from here. A better, cheaper product is sure to come along. And when it does, we may all be reading the classics electronically.
All right, so maybe I should settle back and read The Great Gatsby now. Soak up a little sun.
Off the road!
Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Beyond all the fireworks, barbecues, and hot dog eating contests, the 4th of July is a day for declarations of independence. And that's the theme today for our series, Three Books. These reading recommendations come from writer Will Lehman.
From the moment Huckleberry Finn sat on his raft and decided, all right then, I'll go to hell, great American books have featured people setting off on their own, bound for the new. I'm crazy about three rebellion stories, tales of young folks splitting from parents, from society, and from their past. Each is both personal and political, just right for the July of an election year rife with questions of youth, age, and change. The hero of Joey Goebel's brand new novel, Commonwealth, is in a state of fascinating flux. Blue Jean Maypother rejects his past as a polo shirt-wearing prepster in favor of monster trucks and a mullet. This makes him the black sheep of his wealthy family, that is, until he joins his brother's congressional campaign and woos small-town blue-collar voters with common man charm. All is well until Blue Jean falls for the lead singer of the rock band Uncle Sam's Finger, who points out that Jean's elite family is using him and the rest of the town. Enlightened, angry, and elaborately tattooed, Blue Jean breaks from his family and uses his inheritance to serve the poor, throwing a monkey wrench into his brother's election. Tristan Egolf's 1998 novel, Lord of the Barnyard, is also about a small-town iconoclast. The hero is described as the freak on the tractor, the corn-crib fascist. He takes over his mother's poultry farm with such prodigious skill that he runs afoul of adult authority before the age of 12. And his reckless spirit becomes the subject of myth when he organizes his fellow sanitation workers in a garbage strike just to spite the town for misunderstanding him. Egolf writes like a bottle rocket in the night. Sparks fly. The story zigzags from a barroom brawl to a riot in town hall. It's done with manic hilarity and not a lick of dialogue. The natural precursor to these antic fictions of individuality is Vineland, Thomas Pynchon's 1990 novel about Prairie Wheeler. Prairie's dad is an aging hippie, and her mom vanished during the radical 1960s after selling out her friends to a federal prosecutor. Prairie's quest to track down her mother introduces her to rock and roll, feminist martial arts, and underground filmmaking. Vineland is chock-a-block with hijinks. In what other serious book can you experience a ninja singing the song Just a Floozy with an Uzi? But it also contains Pynchon's most ambivalent and realistic character. Prairie knows she's not like her doper dad, but fears being her turncoat mom. The only smart thing she can do is strike out on her own. Independence, however, is never easy. The characters in these three books fly free of convention, and so does the wild language. I can't think of a better time to enjoy some good, old-fashioned American rebellion than the 4th of July.
Will Lehman is a writer, teacher, and musician in the Washington, D.C. area. His 4th of July recommendations are Joey Goebel's Commonwealth, Tristan Egolf's Lord of the Barnyard, and Vineland by Thomas Pynchon. You can find more suggestions from our series 3 books at npr.org.
The price of crude oil reached a record high this past Thursday, close to $146 per barrel. In the oil-rich nations, it would seem to follow that some of the wealth would trickle down through society, but that's not the case in Nigeria. The country is the 6th largest producer of oil in the world and one of the main suppliers to American customers. The West African nation has been producing and exploring for oil for 50 years. A new book, Curse of the Black Gold, examines the relationship between oil, the environment, and the community. And the picture is not bright. Nigeria is a paradox. In the midst of plenty, there is dire poverty. Ed Kashi is the photographer and co-author of the book, and he joins us from our bureau in New York. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you.
Can you briefly explain exactly what the curse of the black gold is?
The curse in the title really refers to the idea that in the last 50 years, this is the 50th anniversary of oil coming out of the Niger Delta, and they have produced over $600 billion of oil wealth in that time, and yet what it has brought to the people of that region is dire poverty, a lack of development, almost a backwards movement in their development, as well as fed the sort of the corruption that is very real there. I know it's a cliche for those who think of Nigeria as being a corrupted place, and in fact, it really is.
There's a picture on page 20 of some townspeople drying tapioca, I mean, right by an oil flare. So the people are adapting to the oil industry, one could assume from this picture.
I mean, this is what I find all over the world is, you know, the people who have the least are the most resourceful, if you like, because it's about survival. And in this particular instance, this is an oil flow station, a shell flow station, and the flaring, the local people have used the heat of the flare to bake their tapioca. But the thing is, it is not only dangerous to work in that area, but it's like baking a cake from the tailpipe of your car.
What have been some of the effects in the past 50 years on the people's health and on the environment in which they live?
Well, the environment has suffered greatly because of the oil works that, you know, invariably pollute and really have a profound effect on the ecosystem. And the Niger Delta is the second largest riverine system in Africa, you know, one of the largest in the world. But I do have to say that, you know, we all want oil. We all need oil. It has to come from somewhere. And, you know, while it's very easy to point our fingers at the oil companies, and we absolutely need to, it's the Nigerian government that I feel, having spent 3 years working there, that really bears the greatest responsibility. Because after all, our governments are the stewards of our land and our resources and of their people. And as one environmentalist in Nigeria pointed out, because the politicians are not beholden to being voted into power and they get their money from the residual monies that come in from the oil industry, there's a way that they can bypass the people and they don't really have to serve them.
There has been a steep rise in the price of oil. Is it having any effect on the people in the Niger Delta?
Oh, if we spend more money here in America or Europe on oil, it has no impact on the people in the Niger Delta, no positive impact. What it does is just further enriches the power structure from the government people to the chieftain and tribal leaders who all benefit from the rise of the oil prices.
The statistic I took from your book was it produces $2.2 million in oil revenue and the average resident lives on less than a dollar a day.
Exactly. That's $2.2 million a day of oil revenue.
What about production? Is there still as much production of oil in the Niger Delta, or is it beginning to slow down?
Well, what's interesting, they actually Nigeria was just overtaken by Angola as the largest producer of oil in Africa. And I think that has a lot to do with the activities of MEND, which is this militant group, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta. And they sprouted up about 3-4 years ago, and they've become quite aggressive in attacking oil facilities and taking oil workers hostage. And so they have been responsible for shutting in more than a quarter of Nigeria's oil production. And by shutting in, I mean not only stopping that production, but not allowing it from leaving the country.
Hmm. And so that conflict is going to have a negative trickle-down effect, again, on the poor.
Absolutely. And it's also contributing to the increase of oil prices around the world.
Ed Cashy is a photojournalist. His pictures appear in the new book, Curse of the Black Gold, 50 Years of Oil in the Niger Delta. He joined us from our New York bureau. Thank you.
Leanne, thank you so much.
At the end of the 18th century, British poets William Wordsworth and Samuel Taylor Coleridge joined forces for a brief but productive year and launched the English Romantic Movement. It took place in southwest England in the Quantock Hills. Wisconsin Public Radio's Steve Paulson visited the Quantocks to shadow the steps of the poets with Adam Sisman, whose book The Friendship chronicles their creative partnership.
You can almost pinpoint the exact moment when the English Romantic Movement was born. It was a June afternoon a little more than 200 years ago when Samuel Taylor Coleridge, having just walked 40 miles, reached the home of William Wordsworth.
When he arrived within sight of their house, he leapt over a gate. He was so excited to see his old friend Wordsworth, and they had an ecstatic few weeks together.
As Adam Sisman tells the story, Coleridge had only planned to stay a few days, but there was so much electricity during that visit that he ended up staying for 3 weeks. Both Wordsworth and Coleridge decided then and there that they had to live close by so they could remake English poetry. It's an extraordinary story because it cuts so directly against the myth of the solitary artistic genius. Wordsworth and Coleridge fed off each other's enthusiasm and intoxicating ideas. Coleridge was only 24 and known mainly for his fiery political speeches. Wordsworth was 26 and completely unknown as a poet. Somehow they convinced each other they could launch a revolution.
They were groping towards an aesthetic which would speak in the tongues of ordinary men. This is not, emphatically not, a kind of aristocratic poetry written for an elite.
Now, these were two young radicals who had been very taken by the idea of the French Revolution, and then they gave up on that, and they seemed to think that poetry could literally change the world.
Yes, they did, and that idea seems to us now rather amusing. But in fact, this year in the Quantocks was absolutely crucial. It was a watershed in the history of English poetry. After this Quantock year, poetry would never be the same. And all the younger generation of Romantic poets, Shelley, Byron, Keats, looked up to Wordsworth and Coleridge and saw this year in the Quantocks as a kind of sacred year when everything changed.
Both Wordsworth and Coleridge believed that people would find their deepest purpose in nature. By now, with our long history of environmentalism and more recent talk about Gaia, nature itself as a living organism, it's a familiar idea. But it wasn't back then when Coleridge and Wordsworth first laid out their nature aesthetic.
Books, 'tis a dull and endless strife. Come hear the woodland linnet. How sweet his music. On my life there's more of wisdom in it. And hark how blithe the throstle sings, and he is no mean preacher. Come forth into the light of things. Let nature be your teacher.
That's Paul Cheshire, a member of the Friends of Coleridge, reading Wordsworth's poem, The Table Turned. Today you can still walk on the same trails that Wordsworth and Coleridge walked and see some of their favorite places, like the small waterfall near Wordsworth's old house.
They saw this as a place of picturesque beauty, a place which, as one of their friends said, was enough to make a man forget that there was any reason for treason in this world.
Sisman says many of the poet's insights about nature came from Wordsworth's sister, Dorothy, who nearly always joined them on their walks.
She was a kind of wild creature in many ways, and they, to some extent, saw the world, the natural world, through her eyes. She would, for example, notice the way the cloud covered the moon or the sound of an owl, and she would remark on it, and that observation fed its way into their poems. Coleridge has a very striking phrase. He says they were three persons, but one soul.
Above the waterfall, a trail heads up high into the Quantock Hills. Heath covers the moor, and there's a glorious view of the sea out to the west. Coleridge and Wordsworth loved to amble along these paths, often composing their poems while they walked. Perhaps what's most remarkable about their creative partnership was the extent to which they collaborated on the poetry itself. Adam Sizman.
Well, they were always talking about ideas for poems, but also they would actually literally collaborate on some of the poems. So, for example, when Wordsworth was stuck for a line, Coleridge might supply it. Sometimes they would supply whole stanzas to the other's poems, the most famous example of this being The Ancient Mariner.
Down in the valley below, Coleridge's old cottage still stands in the town of Nether Stowey. Today it's run by the National Trust and filled with Coleridge memorabilia, paintings, books, and a table devoted to Coleridge's most famous poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, the strange and hypnotic tale of a sailor who for no good reason shoots an albatross, which brings a terrible curse on his ship and leaves the mariner compelled to tell his story over and over.
He holds him with his skinny hand. There was a ship, quoth he. Hold off, unhand me, greybeard loon. Eftsoons his hand dropped he. He holds him with his glittering eye.
God save the ancient mariner from the fiends that plague thee thus. Why looks thou so? With my crossbow I shot the albatross.
They coiled and swam, and every track was a flash of golden fire. O happy living things, no tongue their beauty might declare.
The Rime of the Ancient Mariner was the longest poem in the book that Wordsworth and Coleridge published in 1798. That book, Lyrical Ballads, was the culmination of their collaboration, and it would launch the English Romantic movement.
And from my neck so free, the albatross fell off and sank like lead into the sea.
Later on, Coleridge and Wordsworth feuded and fell out with each other. But Adam Sizman says we should be grateful that they collaborated for as long as they did. During that one remarkable year in the Quantocks in Somerset, the two poets created a mindset that's inspired generations of people to love and revere the natural world, even those who've never read a line of their poetry.
It was one of those kind of shifts that takes place in worldview, and they pioneered this. They showed us a completely different way of relating to the world, of thinking about the world. And it comes out of not either of them as individuals, but out of their collaboration. That's what's so fascinating. It might never have happened had these two men not come together.
For NPR News, I'm Steve Paulson.
We heard yesterday about how in the mid-1800s, Americans were so enthused about Shakespeare that a rivalry between the two foremost Shakespearean actors led to a riot. Well, there's something that makes modern-day scholars of Shakespeare want to riot, and that's when anyone questions whether the man from Stratford really wrote the works that bear his name. It drives scholars mad. Still, a host of brilliant minds have done just that. Sigmund Freud, Charles Dickens, Orson Welles are among those who didn't believe that Will Shakespeare could have penned those famous plays. This morning, as the curtain rises on the many summer Shakespeare festivals across America, we bring you The Case Against the Man from Stratford.
Hello, my name is Nigel. I'm at the verge of this lovely church, Holy Trinity, so welcome to everyone.
It opens at Holy Trinity Church in Stratford-upon-Avon during a typical tour for lovers of the bard.
You obviously come along to see William Shakespeare. We're standing right in front of his grave now. Let me just tell you a little bit by why Shakespeare is here. Because a lot of people come and tell us it's simply because he wrote all the plays and the stories and what have you, but no.
No, he's buried here because, according to church history, when he died in 1616, this prosperous citizen of Stratford had donated generously to the church. There's an epitaph carved on his gravestone, which reads,
"Good friend, for Jesus' sake forbear to dig the dust enclosed here. Blessed be the man who spares these stones, and cursed be he who moves my bones."
Not exactly the poetry of Shakespeare, but certainly the curse that worked.
It certainly did work, yes, absolutely, and we're very, very grateful for that too, because you know we have people from all over the world come and see Shakespeare.
Those who doubt that the man buried at Trinity Church is the great author Shakespeare point to this rough doggerel. How can it be from the man who wrote, "And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle, life's but a walking shadow." The epitaph is a small piece of what doubters say is a mountain of biographical material suggesting the man from Stratford wasn't a writer.
We have been able to discover over many generations about 70 documents that are related to William Shakespeare of Stratford upon Avon, but none of them are literary.
Taking the stage, English professor Daniel Wright, who directs the Shakespeare Authorship Research Center at Oregon's Concordia University.
They all speak to the activity of a man who is principally a businessman, a man who's delinquent in paying his taxes, who was cited for hoarding grain during a famine. We don't have anyone attesting to him as a playwright, as a poet. And he's the only presumed writer of his time for whom there is no contemporary evidence of a writing career. And many of us find that rather astonishing.
There are playbills that show William Shakespeare appearing as an actor in small parts, legal documents relating to his stake in the Globe Theater. He left a will distributing his precious goods, including, famously, his second best bed. But there's no record that this Shakespeare owned any books, wrote any letters, and the half-dozen signatures attributed to him are on legal documents only. In other words, none of these signatures are signatures at the bottom of Hamlet.
That's correct. If there were a signature at the bottom of Hamlet, we wouldn't be having this debate.
Diana Price wrote the book that's become a Bible for doubters, the meticulously researched Shakespeare's Unorthodox Biography. In it, she details all that Shakespeare would have had to know and be able to use effortlessly in metaphors and intricate puns, archery, astronomy, medicine, technical terms for falconry and royal tennis. The list is long. She argues to link any writer conclusively to the plays.
We would certainly have to be able to support how he learned his languages, how he received his education, how he gained his exposure to the lifestyle of the rich and famous, how he had access to the court. And I don't mean as a servant in the court, but someone who actually was in there where the power playing was going on. We cannot support any of that for Shakespeare.
Mainstream academics mostly deride efforts of independent scholars like Diana Price. It's a tad bit harder to shrug off challenges put with great wit by the likes of Mark Twain. Twain never could reconcile what was known about the man from Stratford with the writer who penned such stuff as Dreams Are Made On. Mark Twain even wrote a pamphlet poking fun at the bard called Is Shakespeare Dead?
It is surmised by the biographers that the young Shakespeare got his vast knowledge of the law and his familiar and accurate acquaintance with the manners and customs and shop talk of lawyers through being for a time the clerk of a Stratford court. Just as a bright lad like me, reared in a village on the banks of the Mississippi, might become perfect in knowledge of the Bering Strait whale fishery and the shop talk of the veteran exercises of that adventure bristling trade through catching catfish with a trot line Sundays.
Mark Twain from 1909. Now we bring on stage one of America's most esteemed Shakespeare scholars.
Like most scholars, I think it's reasonably clear that the man from Stratford wrote the plays, but it's certainly a subject that doesn't go away.
Stephen Greenblatt, professor at Harvard, author of the best-selling biography, Will in the World.
He does seem like he did drop in from another planet. The level of achievement is remarkable.
Remarkable, says Greenblatt, but possible, even for a village lad if he was a genius. Greenblatt has little use for those who question the authorship of Shakespeare's works. He has in the past compared doubters to Holocaust deniers and those who don't believe in evolution. And he says the most powerful evidence of authorship is the simplest, and that's that the name William Shakespeare appeared on some of the plays published during his lifetime.
It's hardly a trivial fact. It's the most significant fact about the publication. It's nothing that gives you the kind of certainty that can never be called into question. Anything can be called into question, but you'd have to have a very strong reason to believe that there was skullduggery or an alternative account. But it's true, as you say, that there are no manuscripts and no letters, but we're talking about something a very long time ago.
Gentle listeners, I can hear your quill pens scratching out furious letters. Scarce can I speak, my collar is so great. at suggesting Gentle Will is not the bard. Those of you whose curiosity has been pricked can go to npr.org for more skepticism from Mark Twain. Tomorrow we hear about one candidate favored to have written under the name Shakespeare and why he would have kept his own name a secret.
Warsaw before the Second World War, wartime Leningrad, modern-day New York. These are the settings for three new thrillers. Our reviewer, Alan Chews, read this trio of novels, and he found intrigue, espionage, murder, and even cannibalism.
Leading off this trio is a novel called The Spies of Warsaw by veteran thriller writer Alan First. As always, his work draws on a particular slice of history. He returns again to that shadowy time of intrigue and political ambiguity when Europe hovered on the verge of World War II. This time around, First has outdone himself in terms of character and atmosphere. At the opening of The Spies of Warsaw, it's autumn, in the waning part of the day, and we feel this premonition of the disaster to come. In the dying light of an autumn day in 1937, First writes, a certain Herr Edvard Uhl, a secret agent, descended from a first-class railway carriage in the city of Warsaw. Above the city, the sky was at war. The last of the sun struck blood-red embers off massed black cloud, while the clear horizon to the west was the color of blue ice. Who does better at scene-setting than this? It just pulls you in. This Edvard Uhl works for an aristocratic French spymaster named Mercier. He's a lonely widower posted at the French embassy in Warsaw. Mercier has a meticulous and passionate commitment to his job, which is spying on the growing German war machine. The intrigue surrounding this and the way he stumbles into a great love affair with a Polish-Parisian woman make the novel just about impossible to put down. The second of our trio of thrillers comes from screenwriter and novelist David Benioff. It's called City of Thieves, and it takes us deep into the middle of some of the worst moments of the Second World War, into the midst of the heroic and starving populace of Leningrad, present-day St. Petersburg, during the Germans' almost 3-year siege. The protagonist, young Lev Benioff, is apparently based on the novelist's grandfather. He's a brash Russian teenager longing to lose his innocence. Lev, along with an AWOL soldier named Kolya, becomes charged with a mission quite impossible, to find a dozen fresh eggs. The eggs are for a wedding cake for the daughter of a powerful secret police officer. This is World War II Leningrad, a city in which those who survive the relentless German bombings are only one meal away from starvation. Lev and his companion make Huck Finn and Jim seem like Boy Scouts. They forage for food, dodge bullets, and escape from cannibals. They do all this as they head out into the freezing, snow-covered, Nazi-occupied forest in search of rumored egg-laying chickens. They find a cottage full of peasant girls enslaved by Nazi officers. The two join a band of vengeful Russian partisans and eventually challenge a Nazi commander to a life-and-death game of chess. This all feels psychologically satisfying and historically authentic, even as the harrowing events in the starving city and in those dark woods take on mythological proportion. Alan First has pre-war Warsaw, David Benioff has Leningrad under siege, and Colin Harrison has modern-day New York. His new thriller, The Finder, is a relentless invention about contemporary business espionage and mayhem. A Chinese entrepreneur vies for the trade secrets of a burgeoning pharmaceutical firm. A big New York investor plans for revenge after he finds out why he's losing millions of dollars in the stock market. A retired New York fireman, a veteran of 9/11, and his dying former detective father attempt to set things right. This makes for a novel that rushes along as though it had an afterburner pushing it toward disaster and beyond. You know the cliché. I went without sleep to finish this one. Not true for me with The Finder. I read it in a couple of sittings. But when I did sleep, I had some awfully troubled dreams.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.